Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to this week's Cast Derby podcast with a K. And I'd like you all to welcome the house band. With me this week is the Cast Derby podcast team of James McLean and Brian Terranova. Say
that's
hello.
Us.
That's you.
Mm.
That's your cue to hello. Say hello.
Hello. Yes, hello.
Hello there. Hello there. Now, Brian.
That is the cue. Yes.
Hi. That is the cue. That is the cue. Now, tell me. What is Labor Day?
Oh, I don't know. It's no. One of the days that I get off from work. That's
that makes
pretty much
three
how
things.
I know it. And let me tell you. There is Labor Day and there is Memorial Day. And every time one of them comes around, I can never remember which is which. All I know is that I get off from work. It's sad. I probably should know this, but I generally don't have a great grasp of our holidays because I generally don't, I'm disinterested, you know, I just don't really mind them. I know like Christmas and Thanksgiving and Halloween. They're like the three that I actually pay attention to.
Okay. James?
What about me?
Yeah, do you know what Labor Day is?
Why would I? It's nothing to do with me.
Oh, no, it's not. Just, you know, keep me involved. Okay.
What's the noises in the background there?
That's
Christian?
That's the Casterbus team working away.
I
the
thought
Casterbus
so.
The news team here at Casterbus Towers working away. That's what that is. Yeah. A little bit high pitched. So no, we've employed Munchkins.
We have. We say employed in the very loosest sense, being as I just said, there's no labour laws for Munchkins.
Well, they're Munchkins, of course, so there's no labour laws. They're not human, so those kind of things don't apply. So
exactly. So we would treat them well.
They've all got their own sonic screwdriver.
They have, yeah.
Ooh, I didn't know we were treating them that well.
Maybe attached to a small power line, which leads to the mains, and every time they don't work very well, I flick a switch just to improve productivity.
Better, much better.
It is, indeed. Yeah. It is.
Indeed. We're here to talk about Doctor Who, not Munchkins and newsrooms and indeed, Labour Day. So, it's been a strange week for Doctor Who news. We had that news of that bizarre tweet from John Hurt in which he intimated, I think probably his publicist, intimated that he would be appearing alongside the 12th Doctor. Which opens up all manner of interesting theories, not just about the Hurt Doctor, mainly about the Hurt Doctor, but how Doctor Who might continue. The tweet itself was undone, and we'll link to it in the podcast show notes. So it was undone, it was revised, and then a sort of more legible version was printed. But it did suggest that the two would be appearing together. What do you think?
The original one before it was deleted definitely had that kind of suggestion. I'm trying to actually find the tweet again because, you know, I read it originally and now I'm trying to get the exact wording because now it just occurs to me. I know it's ongoing right now.
Okay.
But it occurs to me that it does sound like they were potentially going to be working together, but does that necessarily mean Doctor Who? That's why I wanted to see the wording again, because it definitely seemed like he let something slip about them working together in Doctor Who from what I recall when I originally read it.
Right. I remember you got quite excited by it. It's not often you send me links.
Yeah, well, if I find stuff, I send you links. I wasn't so much excited about the prospect of him appearing again as much as it was just like, oh, wow, look at this slip up. Yeah, I'll be honest, I haven't seen him yet, so I don't know if I'm going to enjoy him yet or not, still the prospect, the idea of the character is just not one that appeals to me very much, if I'm honest. So we'll see how I feel after the 50th. Maybe it'll be a well-done storyline, but I am curious because it does make it seem like things will be bleeding on into Capaldi's era.
That's what the message was initially, was congratulations, Peter Capaldi. This is obviously it was shortly after the announcement that Peter Capaldi would be the 12th Doctor. Congratulations, Peter Capaldi. I'm sub-off, and we will have a lot of fun, which kind of reads as though it's possibly, I'm sure, both of us, or both he and I, or something. It's difficult to say. It's clearly a typo, and it was revised a little later on. With a more legible version that actually made sense. That does read, though, as though he's expecting to be working, or his publicist or whatever, his social media wrangler is expecting him to work alongside Peter Capaldi, which to me says that he's not the 8 1/2 doctor. He says to me that he's the Valiard.
Okay, run that by me again. Where did that logic leap
from? Okay, right, simple.
Okay.
Sort of simple.
Right.
Right. What I'm thinking is that along the lines of...
My eyes are closed.
Everyone thinks he's the 8 1/2 doctor at the moment.
Yes, okay. He is.
Yeah. What if he's not 8.5? What if he's the Valiard who travelled back in time to avert or change the Time War, which is how the 11th Doctor knows him? That's how he recognises him and how he knows. Because we know the Valiard isn't called the Doctor. He's discarded the name of the Doctor because he doesn't want to be called the Doctor. He's called the Valiard. And that we know that the John Hurt Doctor isn't called the Doctor, even though he's called the Doctor on screen.
I would definitely love that to be true myself for many reasons. But I don't know. When it comes to Moff, I just kind of feel like the things that make sense aren't the way it's going to be.
Okay. James?
Nah, you're barking up the wrong tree, mate. You need to get a ticket from our workers and just fly over there and spend some time there, because that's where you belong. It's Munchkin talk. It's Munchkins. No, I don't think so. I think it's quite simply he is the ninth doctor. He's not the 8 1/2. He is the ninth doctor, purely. And it's just simply that the doctor has revoked the name from him out of disgust for his actions. And they just...
What actions? What's he done?
He's a Time Lord. He's a Time War Doctor, which means the horrendous things which the Doctor's very guilty about during the Time War are the things which his Doctor committed, which is why the Ninth Doctor feels so much guilt and burden for the horrendous crime of genocide, if nothing else, that was committed by this Doctor. That to me is the most rational and I think the most exciting, dramatic thing. I think the Valiard was such a tediously half-baked idea that had potential, but in the end just culminates into having the Doctor having his own Moriarty, which in a sense was so funny because you thought, well, we don't need the Valiard, and you've proved it, because in the episode we've got our Valiard, which is the Master. He is the Valiard in the sense of the character interaction, so you don't need him. And I know that's hard, because I know the Valiard is also working down there, covered with Munchkins in Cerberus Towers on his next bit for the magazine, so he won't lie to hear that, and he won't be able to hear it because of the high-pitched squealing of the Munchkins, which, as we've noticed, have left us to go downstairs to torment him.
Well, let's just hope he doesn't find out, because you will probably die.
Oh, rubbish. He's useless, the Valiard. He didn't kill anyone. He spent all his time posturingly badly in front of Linda Bellingham, and then at the end sort of deviously... disappeared into the darkness and never came back. I mean, and the other reason I think I'd have to humbly say that you're wrong, well, not humbly, politely say, no, I won't even be polite, you're wrong. The reason you're wrong is in the narrative script, they actually mention the Valiard as one of the names the Doctor has. Now, I think that would be extremely bad writing to mention the Valiard as someone that the Doctor could be and here is. Oh, by the way, he is actually the Valiard. He's one of these names.
Wouldn't that just be a bit of foreshadowing?
No, yeah. I don't think so. I think that would be dodgy writing. It would be foreshadowing.
It would also be set up like Saxon or Torchwood or Bad Wolf.
Yeah, but when you do a setup in that sort of approach or in a sort of Chekhov's gun approach, you do it at least an act beforehand. You don't do it just before you reveal the person. The Doctor has had many names, so and so and so and so, and then here he is, the Doctor. He's actually one of those names.
As we've already discussed, the name of the Doctor was a very poorly structured story to begin with.
It is, yeah, I agree. But I don't. While I don't like the way that Moffat writes, I think that would be a bit of very amateurish writing to have actually have one of the names put in that he is actually. I don't know. I think, as I've said before, I think it's a far more interesting. I know Brian doesn't like it particularly, but to have the Doctor being. And this, as I say, because it goes back to the New Adventures. They sort of did this with McCoy, to have the Doctor being something which is so against what the Doctor is, which sort of kind of makes sense, because we saw in Baker's era how to commit genocide against the Daleks was something he couldn't do. Now, by the inference from this new series, what the Doctor did in the Time War was the equivalent of that genocide. Mm. And you perhaps have to argue that that would be so anti-doctor. For a doctor to be able to do that, he'd have to be something which the doctor himself would reject. So I think it is an interesting idea that he is the ninth doctor. I think it's a very clever idea. And I understand what you mean. And I think from a fan point of view, it would be lovely to have the Valiard back. Just because in the sense of never having the Valiard ever spoken again, it sort of belittles the trial of the Time Lord little. Because he becomes a bit of a nothing. A forgotten idea. And it is such a major idea. So I see what you mean. It would be interesting because in that sense, at least it would give the Valiard some justice.
Hmm.
So, but yeah, I see that.
I'm sorry, but yeah, the thing is with having him be the Doctor, having him be the Ninth Doctor, the one who fought in the Time War, kind of what you're saying about the Valiard, it belittles the history of Doctor Who again, because it's just Moffat rewriting all of Doctor Who's history so that he is the one who's in charge and made everything happen again. You know,
yes.
He's now taking this story that Russell created,
yes,
which is very intriguing. And yeah, I know we would all like to see more about the Time War, but, you know, everybody had visions of the Eighth Doctor or the Ninth Doctor fighting in this war, and either one would have made me very happy. But now it's some Doctor that we don't even know.
Mm.
We've never met before. It's some creation of Moffat to make him go, yes, that's right. Everything that I've ever written is the history of Doctor Who. And that's what puts me off. And the fact that, you know, just because they decide to not call him the Doctor, and he doesn't count as one of the Doctor's lives. We've had other people throughout the show, throughout the history, kind of mention what life the Doctor was already on. You know, and I mean, the 10th Doctor even tells Sarah Jane, I've regenerated a half a dozen times since we last met. Okay, fine. If you want to think that she remembered the events of the five Doctors, then hey, the counting and the math makes sense. But it just doesn't jive. It just doesn't work for me. It's like, just because you did something wrong during this war, which, by the way, David Tennant did too at the end of his whole era. You know, he sent the Time Lords back into that mess. So, you know, he's capable of it, too. They should strip him of his name and his number and, you know, have Matt Smith be the 10th Doctor and just forget about David Tennant, too. It just doesn't make sense. It's poor writing to me. It's poor. It's going to be a poor setup. I especially after the name of the Doctor, I don't have high hopes for the 50th. I hope I'm wrong. I really do. But I just think that you know, anytime Moffat tries to play with history or continuity in the show, it ends up poorly.
I mean, to be fair, though, I mean, the Tennant's approach was actually revising what had already been committed. So, and in Doctor Who, they tend to seem to think that if an action's been done, you can let it play on and you don't take the burden of that in the sense.
Okay, but
let me
counter with this. The Time Lords were going to wipe out all of reality, just like the Daleks did in Series 4, or were trying to do. But they were going to wipe out all of reality and become the ultimate thing. And apparently, according to Tennant, that's what they were going to do in the Time War. So what did John Hurt, as the Doctor, do wrong if he saved the entire reality?
I think there's going to be something more. I think if it is just simply that we see him press the big red button that gets rid of the Time Lords and the Daleks, I think that would be... I think there's going to be a little more to it than that, because that is already given, as you say. It's something we already know.
But that's the point. Like, where else can you go now? Tennant says that he got rid of the Time Lords because of that plan. You know, like what else is there then? Oh,
well,
you know,
I
forgot to mention this other thing that, you know, they changed their mind last minute. They were going to give everybody cake and let them eat it and have fun. But, you know, I decided screw that because my plan was already set in motion. I'm calling myself Fred today. I'm going to press this button and blow up all of the Time Lords in this Time War. And, you know, maybe I'll regenerate and you guys can forget about me. You know, it's silly. To me. And, you know, like I said, I haven't seen it. It could be great. It could be the best piece of Doctor Who ever, though I highly doubt it. But it could be. It just seems, the premise seems silly. I think bringing back somebody like the Valiard, or bringing in such a new concept, something more interesting that isn't actually the Doctor, although, you know, here's the other thing. Clara says she's gone throughout all his history and she's seen all 11 faces. But then the Doctor says, oh, wait, but this guy, you know, it is me. And even the titles on the screen flash up, it is him. Well, then why didn't Clara see it?
Because it's time bubble. It's time war. It's enclosed.
Time lock.
Right. So he's stuck in the time lock, but he survived the time war.
But he's in the Doctor's head.
Yeah.
He hasn't survived the time war, is he? They're in the doctor's head at that
So then he's in the doctor's head. Timeline, and then what? He's going to be in the doctor's head for the entire 50th anniversary as
well? I'm saying that's why there's been no reference to him. It will be because he's time-locked. That's why he'll be so divorced from everything, that it doesn't really affect anything that's been said, because technically... for the doctor. And to be fair, you know, I'm not usually the one who is trying to justify Moffat's work, which is kind of weird. It's kind of cool. But I had a great auntie who I think it was like my great grandfather, my great great grandfather. He died on the HMS Hood, which interesting enough is the the vessel which John Pertwee have escaped from. And we found out recently we did a check and he didn't. And he was never actually on the Hood at all. And basically his wife decided to remove him from the history of our family and told everyone that he died on the Hood, and he had been divorced and removed from the family and lived in London, which sounds so ridiculous that you can't imagine, well, how would that work? Surely he would get in contact. You think there's too many plot holes there, but apparently that's what happened, and the time was, and eventually continuity was rewritten like that. So we all thought he passed away on the Hood, but he came back. So in a sense, I can sort of understand the idea of the Doctor relegating to the point where he doesn't even reference him as an incarnation. He is such an abhorrency to what he's done. I think what Brian said is very true, though. How they actually justify it is a tall order, because they've already said to everyone that the Doctor clearly admits that he had to do bad things in the Time War. So why is this character such an issue if he already admits to doing them himself?
Yeah.
So that is going to be something he's going to have to reconcile. And I think to do that, there's going to have to be some drama. And I think it will have to be how he does it is going to be something which is against everything that the Doctor would have to be, whether it has to be through deceit, through tricks, betrayal. I think there's got to be a slightly darker element that the Time War took the Doctor into as a dark place as Rassilon. And I think that's where it's going. It's saying Rassilon went mad.
Yeah. I suppose there's a possibility that there was something, some key element during the war that led the Time Lords to come up with their plan, which is why the Doctor ended the war. And maybe John Hurt is tied with that key element.
Could be, yeah.
But he's not the one who ended the war. It's still, you know, I just...
The whole idea of there being an
incarnation of the Doctor that just isn't counted as the Doctor because he doesn't call himself that, or he did something bad. It's like, you know, the first Doctor was ready to bash a caveman on the head with a rock just to get away because he was afraid of the Time Lords. You know, but the other Doctors don't discount him or discredit him. You know, is it just because he didn't do it, because Ian stopped him? It's just... I don't know. I mean, whatever they're going to do, whatever they're going to show the Doctor being capable of as this Hurt version, on one way, I don't want them to taint the character. And on the other hand, I just kind of feel like it's a shame that here's more continuity that we've known about. And sure, we've never seen the Time War, we don't know about it. But, you know, these two Time Lords, these two characters are pretty much locked within it, the eighth and the ninth. Like which one of them did it? Which one? There's so much rich possibilities there.
Yes, absolutely.
Instead, Moffat just creates his own. And, you know, I don't believe for a second that he's not going to give us links to the past the way that he made his quote that, you know, anniversary should be about moving forward. I don't believe that for a second. He lies all the time. I get that. But more of his past for Doctor Who, more of his recreating the past is not something I think the show needs, just because it's self-indulgent, and I don't think that he has the best interest of the show at heart when he's doing it.
I think what would be interesting, and he's not done it by the looks of it, unless McGann is being particularly coy as Moffat, I can understand him not going, thinking, right, what I could do is I could show McGann going down a really bad road to the point where he regenerates into the ninth for his crimes, and because I mean Big Finish is going down, went down a bit of that road with McGann. I can see him not doing that because, like John Nathan Turner, like Russell T Davis, there is a logic. If you can get someone like John Hurt into your show, that's a big, as Kasturbaris noticed in its traffic when John Hurt was announced, that's a big coup. So I can understand why he'd go, right, it'd be better to do this with a total special star Doctor rather than Paul McGann, because Paul McGann's not going to get that interest. But at the same time, you could still have an aspect of Paul McGann being in there, which takes him into being John Hurt, which I think would be nice for Paul McGann to have some sort of television relevance, and for the audience, because, you know, 0.1% of the audience will have listened to Big Finish and Paul McGann on Big Finish. you know, it had been given him some sort of relevance in the 50th that leads to your guest star, which...
Yeah. Again, Big Finish would be a boost as well.
Absolutely.
I do, listen, here's the thing. I get that. And you know, at the same time, you know, do I want to see Paul McGann go down this dark route? You know, I'm sure they would handle it differently and hopefully not make Paul be the doctor that everybody just thinks is either going from the one-off to the one who, you know, became evil or whatever. I don't want to see that. So I see why getting some other actor being like the darker one, fine. However, I think they could have portrayed it better, a bit more, showing a bit more conflict for him if they brought in Paul or even if Chris had stayed on for it. But to bring in somebody new and say, wow, he's got star power on your number one TV show that doesn't have any issue getting ratings whatsoever, to bring in this star power, it seems to me like you're doing it, you know, just for the gimmick of it when you don't even need to do it for the gimmick of it. And that's why I'm hoping it doesn't fail, because you're bringing in somebody. Sure, John Hurt's a great actor, and I'm sure he will bring a lot to the part. But, you know, it seems to me like it was very unnecessary. The show doesn't need that kind of pull to try and get people to watch it. People are dying to see this. People are dying to just see the trailer, so much so that, you know, they're making fan ones that people are drooling about out there. You know, this I don't see the attraction for this. I really don't.
Okay, let's move on. Because dare say we'll be talking about this a lot in the future, and particularly probably on, you know, November the 25th or thereabouts after the episode has aired. Brian, turn over. You're involved in this next item, and again, so is John Hurt. There was a photo leaked taken at Edinburgh Television Festival from a brief trailer, another one of the 50th anniversary show. And I should point out as well at this point. I mentioned at this point that the BBC has released its original drama trailer for the autumn season, and there's no Doctor Who in there. I don't think we should take that as a slight. I think we should take that as the fact that there's only one episode of Doctor Who and not a series. Bit disappointing, but there's some Sherlock in there, and some Peter Capaldi in the Three Musketeers, and some David Tennant in The Escape Artist, so look out for that on Casterbus. So, back to this photo of the three Doctors. The 10th, the 11th, and the John Hurt, nth Doctor. And then another figure, a shadowy figure, to the right of the screen that almost looks like our own Brian Terranova in his 10th Doctor guise. Now, what it really must be is a transition between two scenes or two shots.
Yeah.
But some people on Casterbus have suggested that it's actually Brian, which is hilarious.
I love the fact, too, that, you know, the suggestion is that it's a reflection of me in the screen while taking my own photograph. But it's a projection screen. You're not going to get a reflection of me in there. You know, it's just that's not going to happen. But yeah, no, I wish it was me, because then I would have seen the trailer and I would have been able to tell you guys some pretty cool things about it, aside from what we've just read on the Internet. And I don't think I would have had any qualms actually saying, hey, I took a photo. Probably wouldn't have gotten invited back, but hey, I'm kind of stupid like that, I guess.
And you live in America, and it was in Edinburgh.
Yeah, that's
shut up, you munchkin.
Munchkin.
Get back to work.
But no, I mean, it's a trailer, and the fact that, you know, Tennant is wearing his glasses in that moment doesn't make any difference, because it's not the actual episode, so it's not poor editing. You know, it's a trailer, so scenes are generally edited out of order. But that's clearly him. He's wearing the 50th tie, the suit, the dark shirt. It's him, you know? Besides, that's not my jawline.
No, indeed. But what I want to know is, has our listener ever been mistaken for a Doctor Who character? That'll be fascinating to learn. So if you have, let us know in the comments or drop us an email or tweet us. And we'll maybe have a look at it again next week. I have never been mistaken for a Doctor Who monster. I could probably have played a few with my height. You know, wearing the old rubber suits, what have you.
You're thinking sort of old Cybermen, things
I'm like
that.
I'm thinking of old Cybermen and Ice Warriors, yeah. But what about you, James? You ever been mistaken for a Doctor Who monster?
No, I used to, when I was at music college, there was a
You went
a
to lovely... music college?
Yeah.
Did you?
Yeah, lovely. Well, a college did music. I did, I might be a difference between the two. I'm not sure. It wasn't that grand. It wasn't particularly brilliant. Anyway, there was a lovely, lovely lady, girl there, had special needs issues. Never quite sure what they were. Very unusual. She used to go and play on keyboard. She used to talk like that. I don't know why. I go play keyboard. And she used to call me Mulder. Because why? She thought I looked a bit like Mulder. And she's like, oh, right. Mulder, I play right. keyboard. Hmm. So that's the only person I've sort of been vaguely...
Okay. I used to... People used to tell me that it looked like Hugh Grant, which I thought was a bit optimistic. And then when Richard E. Grant became a little more famous, people used to say I look like Richard E. Grant.
Ah, that's all right.
Well, that's okay. I like Richard E. Grant, so that's fine. That's not a problem for me. Firstly, I don't think I look like either of them. I look
Hugh Grant's...
kind of like me, really.
Hugh Grant's too posh and proper for you, really, isn't he?
Yep. And he's got this stumbling stutter type thing going on.
Yeah, he's got stumbling stutter.
That thing.
I tend to do that myself, really. But yeah.
Indeed.
I sometimes get Anyway,
I can actually do a sort of a posher accent, but I kind of choose not to because I'm a Yorkshireman.
Oh, I've broken another one of my tablet sticks.
Tablet sticks? What are these?
Yeah. The things with the spongy ends, which you use on tablets.
Oh, stylus.
Stylus, yeah. I've broken another one of those.
Okay.
Where's one of the munchkins? They can come and fix it. They've got quite a gluey spit, munchkins. They can sort of just...
Nice.
It's very good. Well, how do you think I repaired the doors down in the basement?
I didn't like to ask, to be honest with you.
No. Oh.
Yeah, indeed.
Well, especially after last time, yeah.
Well, yeah, true. Peter Capaldi is the 12th Doctor.
What?
Peter Capaldi is the 12th. I still can't get over this.
When did that happen?
That was a few weeks ago. You weren't here. It was really good. Me and James did a live podcast on YouTube, on Google Hangouts, like we did last week. And then we accidentally had the TV in the background.
Mm,
it was genuinely an accident, by the way. Mm. You would know if it wasn't, because I'd be saying things like, oh, that was accidental, wasn't it? But no, it truly was genuinely accidental. So Peter Capaldi, the 12th Doctor, revealed recently that he burned his first and second Doctor autographs. We presume that's what they were anyway. They were classic era Doctor autographs. And he burned them, along with loads of other stuff, in order to put his geekery in a box of history and move on from some kind of bonfire of the nerds. I find it very, really, really quite sad, isn't it? That anyone should get to that. That someone should find themselves in that place, emotionally or psychologically or whatever, that the things that they hold dear need to be destroyed.
Well, yeah. Once upon a time, being a geek or a nerd wasn't a cool thing, and people took a lot of crap for it. So I can understand him getting upset and wanting to try and move away from it. But I will say, you know, just the mere fact of him doing that alone, I'm sure he has enough regret in that to be punished, I guess, on his own. You know, it's a shame to get to the point where you feel embarrassed by it enough to just want to make it all disappear like that. So I'm sure, you know, it was a rough time. I'm sure he feels bad about it.
Completely. You ever done anything like that, James?
I did have Anthony Ainley's autograph, which I lost, which was on the back of a piece of Mark of the Rani Who script.
I don't think that counts. Did you burn it?
I didn't burn it, but I lost it, so I was negligent. But, right. I mean, in the end, maybe this is exactly the sort of thing which is the core nub of the 23rd and 50th anniversary special, is the fact that John Hurt is the guy. That's why I changed it to 50th. I don't know why my brain still thinks it's 1986 or whatever, but it does. Okay.
Trial of a Time Lord. That's a cracking 23rd anniversary story, wasn't it?
I'm still getting over it. That EastEnders isn't going to last, I can tell you that.
And the Valiard. What about him, eh?
The Valiard. Well, you know. Yeah, absolutely. I think he's brilliant. I didn't see that coming at all. And Mel, I can't wait to see future series of Mel. I think she's going to be great. Next season, Colin Baker's going to be back. He's going to be fab. It's going to be Mel. Yeah. I don't know. Well, you totally lost the point that I was making, which wasn't even particularly funny, but it just seemed to be interesting. No, it wasn't. Let's move on. Oh, I need to...
Well, you know, the nearest thing I've ever come was putting my Transformers in a box, basically. That's the nearest I've come to ever burning toys and moving on. I put my Transformers in a box for, I don't know, 2 months once.
No, I don't think that's bad. I mean, I've done that before where, you know, you have things all about and then all of a sudden you're just kind of not in the mood for them. You box them up, but then you come back to them a little bit later. You know, it's a mood thing. I get that. I have never burnt or discarded anything. I've actually always embraced it. You know, like I said, kids can be cruel, so you take a lot of crap for the things that you like. But I always figured if I was going to be taking the crap, why hide what I was actually into? However, a couple years ago, maybe 2 years ago at this point now, I guess, when I moved, I realized I had a lot of crap. Just a lot of stuff stored in boxes that I just never looked at. And in this case, it was two huge comic boxes of Doctor Who magazines that I thought I would keep for various reasons. But I had canceled my subscription because at the time I wasn't feeling the articles very well. And I just never looked at the books again, despite the fact that there were some great articles and photos in there. And it just occurred to me I was moving from one state to the next and I didn't feel like hauling this stuff around. So I actually gave it all away. Granted, it was just books and a couple miscellaneous toys. I still have most of the things that I do collect. I don't honestly regret it, but sometimes I think about, wow, that one issue was cool. I wouldn't mind reading that one again. But I think it actually was a good move.
I did that with all my Doctor Who magazines. I got rid of pretty much all my New Adventures, and I had most of them, which was a stupid move in retrospect. I've only got a few left, like Just War. But even them I don't read. But you do it, and I do it because I don't want to be laden with crap. Under my bed at the moment, there is too much crap, and it frustrates me. Because it never does you any good. Yet at the same time, everything I get rid of, I tend to need. I mean, last week I was very fortunate enough to interview Barbara Bain. And I used to have a fantastic book on Mission Impossible, which told you all the background and the details to every season. It was one of those big compendium things. And I got rid of it. I think, oh, I won't need it anymore. I've read it. And, you know, I could have just done with it for that one instance. And so it always bites you. You know, people say, just get rid of your crap. And you think, yeah, you should. But you'll always find you'll regret it because you'll always need it sometime in the future, that one thing you got rid of.
I also, I completely agree with that. Like, there are plenty of times when I did give away something where later it was like, oh, darn it, could have used that. But, you know, like, for the most part, it's a lot of mild regret because it made sense to get rid of it, you know? I will say, though, I'm not exactly a big autograph guy. If I meet somebody and I respect their work, I generally like to get a photo because that means more to me. Like, it shows I've actually met this person than getting an autograph where, you know, if you don't get a picture of them actually signing it in front of you, who's going to know that you actually have their real autograph? You know, I just never, having somebody's signature down on something just never really appealed to me, which is why. You know, for instance, I got years ago when Big Finish put out an Eighth Doctor story called Caerdroia. They had two covers. There was one that was art, you know, it was drawn. It was maybe done on Illustrator or something, but it was not actual photographs of the actors. And that's what Big Finish sold. But then this other company, and I forget who it was at the time now, had put out this secondary cover that they had gotten exclusively for their company. So you could buy the CD from them. And it did have an actual picture of Paul McGann on the cover and a couple of the other actors or one of the other actors from the piece. And to me, since I'm listening to something on audio, the visuals that I want in my head are of the actual actors. So when I get a cover that is drawn and it looked like a cartoon, then for some reason when I'm listening to that story, I have that cover in my head and that's how things start to play out. And I have a very active imagination, but however, sometimes it can get caught. So I wanted this other cover because I liked it better. When I ordered it from them, they had two versions, autographed and non-autographed, and I chose non-autographed. When I got it in the mail, I actually got the autographed copy, and I must be the only guy in the world to have contacted the company and said, hey, look, I really wanted the non-autographed copy. Can I exchange this out, you know? And they let me keep it. They said, don't worry about it, keep it. We'll send you another rather than me send it back. But it was like the autograph was over the cover. It was to me, it was ruining the artwork, you know? And I didn't want that. And I've done it many times. Like when you and I went to Dimensions, I think the second time, Dimensions Convention, and we met Paul McGann and Daphne Ashbrook and Sylvester McCoy.
Yeah.
I just gave them the pamphlet for the convention because I just wanted to go say hello to them. You know, I didn't really need them to sign anything, but I felt awkward being in line, not having anything for them to sign. You know, and likewise, I met the band They Might Be Giants. I pulled a dollar out of my pocket because I'm like, I don't have anything. I didn't want them to sign an album cover. I didn't want the. I just want to say hello. You know. Yeah.
Same here. I can't remember what it. Well, we got something signed for Kerry from Paul McGann because I didn't particularly want to. We had something else signed for a competition.
Yeah.
And then for myself, just to say hello, like yourself, and I really didn't have anything to sign, so I got him to sign something for Kerry and tell her to watch with Neil and I.
Yeah, I like to try and get something. I always feel a bit embarrassed getting autographs, so I go, I ask for, I don't know, just like their underwear or something really personal like that. And
You ask for that. Don't you just dig for their trash for that? It's so much easier.
Well, it depends. If I've actually found it in their trash, then yeah, I won't go and speak to them because I won't need it because I've got their underwear.
You'll be wearing it.
I don't speak to them anymore. Yeah. I like to do that. It's good. And I might go and show them that I'm wearing their underwear. That sometimes works for me. It's sort of
nothing shows devotion quite like that.
It's a bit of a turn on, to be honest. And it's pretty damn cool. And you know, if I can get a photo with me wearing their underwear while they're there before the police come, I'm all good with that. But inevitably, the police get there pretty quick, and the underwear is returned. It never ends well.
I really don't know how we got here.
I don't know either.
Wait, it's on the topic list that I have right here. James stealing celebrity underwear.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's number six on there. You don't have it?
No, I don't know that. No, oh, okay. I've got fan title sequences.
Oh, fantastic
oh,
sequences!
Those things. Yeah. Dear listener, if you didn't see the awesome fan title sequence the other day on Castoris, and I urge you to go find it. This is a fan title sequence, opening titles of Doctor Who, for the 12th Doctor era, and they're kind of they're beautiful. As a brief description, because obviously I can't show you them right now while you're listening in your car, possibly listening on the Stitcher app. Or on maybe you're listening on Audio Boo. I can't show you, but I can tell you. Think of the last series of Doctor Who, with the most recent 11th Doctor titles, which I thought were awesome, and then kind of make them more colourful and more blocky, more 3D, more items in there seeming more tangible, and the face of Peter Capaldi as well. Nice touch. And that'll put you in mind of how good this opening title sequence, made by a comparative amateur in terms of the fact that he isn't working for the BBC, although he perhaps should be. They're beautiful. Guys, they are, aren't they? Possibly the only stumble is with the logo, I think.
Yeah, I mean...
Although I do like, with the logo, I don't know if you notice this, as the logo comes forward, it wobbles slightly. not in a shaky cardboard wall sort of way, but in a kind of moving through space slightly. Very, very nice touch.
It's one of those sort of things where I'm not very good at spotting. I swear I feel quite old. I mean, I was talking to my boss, who's obviously, as I've said before, video games, and you know, sort of saying, you know, I get kind of humbled these days, where at one point I used to sort of watch the TV or adverts and I could see how everything was done, and you could, that was it, and it was just a question of whether you thought it was reasonably done okay.
Yeah.
But now the transitions are so perfect with the use of digital trickeries, and he was saying, yeah, but if you watch them, a lot of this stuff, especially the CG stuff, and especially in a lot of this stuff you'll find on YouTube like that, you can see how he says so much of it is now based down to the program rather than who's beeping me? Is it you? Oh, right. God's sake. We seem to be doing this every week. We seem to have to do this, Brian. We have to cover for Christian having to go off to do something and then pretend as if we're just talking and he's still here. I'm not doing it this week. No. Wait. Awkward silence. There. That's because of him. It's not because of us.
You know,
we're
that
fine.
Made me feel very awkward, James.
It did. But yeah, with CG, you know, there is so much of it is now down to a certain degree, down to the software that you have. You can do lots of wonderful stuff which can look fantastic.
Oh, yeah.
But, you know, the true experts will be able to see where you're relying too much on the software rather than the actual skill in using it. But so I can't tell with the stuff. I really can't see between the two. I'm too old-fashioned. And it looked great for me. Yeah, the logo didn't quite fit for me. The logos, I think sometimes maybe that is where you can see someone who is extremely good at the craft in as much an artistic sense as in a programming, as in a software manipulation sense, is because you'll see this fantastic stuff and it'll come to the logo and the logo will look wrong. And it's as if they haven't seen that that's wrong or they can't do it right. I don't want to be knocking this guy because it is a great thing. But it sometimes always is a logo which seems to tell you whether it's amateur or professional. Do you know what I mean?
Well, do you know? I mean, I definitely know what you're saying. I'll put it to you this way. The professionals definitely have better software, period.
Yes, definitely.
You know, and they also sometimes have more time. Not to say that this was knocked together quickly, but sometimes, you know, they have more time to spend in it.
Definitely. Yeah.
I watched it. I thought that it was a very nice title sequence, but it's funny because earlier in the day, before that was actually posted, I had seen another one, which was actually done by Auton 710. It's called the Doctor Who 50th Anniversary title sequence. Now, it's not strictly for Capaldi. As a matter of fact, obviously, he's not in it. It's all the Doctors up through 11. And actually, if you want, I'll go ahead and pop a link in there for you guys. I found this one to be very good, very, very interesting myself. I remove the fact that it has all 11 Doctor's faces in it. Don't make it be just for the 50th. Make it actually be for Capaldi. One of my favorite things about it, actually two combined, I guess, is the TARDIS at the end. The reason that I love it is because... And first of all, I do love the way the logo, when you get to the logo kind of like explodes, you know, rather than just like float off screen. I actually think that's very cool. But when they get to the TARDIS, it comes up with the title sequence, or excuse me, the title cue for the episode plus who it's written by. And the TARDIS flies up from behind it. And then it kind of goes under and over the letters, which I think is very cool. It's just like it's not pretending that the letters aren't there, you know, it flies right up in front of them. But my absolute favorite part about that is... at the very end of it, the TARDIS goes up to the upper left hand of the screen, the viewer's left hand of the screen, and flies across the screen, which brings us into the show rather than the TARDIS doors opening, which I always think looks hokey. Ever since they started doing that, I just felt it looked really cheap. And actually, to be honest, for being in the TV show, I felt that looked fan-made. I felt that looked like a fan idea. But when you see the TARDIS fly across the screen in this Auton 710 one, and then it shows like what would be the beginning of an episode. It shows a planet with the TARDIS flying in the view. I think that looks immaculate right there. It looks beautiful.
But it's a shocking... I don't want to knock the BBC, but the one thing I found consistently bad is their, as we've said before, is their CG TARDIS prop is terrible. And in that opening sequence, the one that we see is pretty bad. And when it actually comes up and the doors open, you're thinking, what? Yeah. Just don't, because it's not that good. Whether they've got several, I don't know, because I say it's not... different resolution ones, but it never looks very good. Interesting enough, title sequence. I'm just going to post this to you guys off the bat. This is, I've seen a couple of these of late. I was watching them last night. This is a title sequence for series 6A done to the Red Dwarf openings. And again, the title at the end is very bad. It's a logo. It doesn't work very well for me. I'm sorry, I don't want to say it's bad. But the rest of it is very well montaged together, capturing the cues in the music. And it just flips the whole thing. And it actually makes it quite exciting. It's a good montage music.
It really is, yeah. That's funny.
It really makes it... You want to watch it.
Yeah, but do you think Doctor Who... would benefit from a title sequence like this?
I don't think I want to see it being
like a clip show thing for Doctor Who. It just doesn't seem right. But it is funny. You're right. It's so funny because it's actually extremely apt for
I always used to like when Red Dwarf started doing that because it was a very nice, fun way to sort of give you a little flavor of the season. Mm-hmm. And I agree that you can't do it with Doctor Who. Doctor's not the right show. It just wouldn't fit. But at the same time, it's fun seeing them do it. There's a few people who've done it. They've done a... There was another one done to the first season of Doctor Who, of Matt's Doctor Who, and that's very good as well. We'll obviously put these in the links for this podcast, so you can all see it as well. But yeah, so they're fun. So what is your favourite title sequences then, boys?
What, of Doctor Who?
Yeah, yeah. I know you're trying to pretend like you were here all the time, but you weren't. No.
Actually, thanks to the wonders of volume, I heard everything.
Damn.
My favorite. Oh, do you know? I loved the title sequence in 2005 because it felt like it was Doctor Who starting. But then again, I loved the title sequence in 1996, and in hindsight, it's not as good as I thought it was at the time. Although it is striking, it's very difficult. I mean, I like the John Pertwee titles as well. I like looking out for the Darth Vader helmet in the John Pertwee titles.
Mm-hmm.
If you haven't ever done that, dear listener, that's when the shape of the pulsing lines sort of arches in towards the top, and it looks slightly like Darth Vader's helmet. But I think it's got to be the Tom Baker titles, the 74 to 80 Tom Baker titles. 74, 79, depends on how you want to shake it. I don't think it's got better than that. I don't care how much CGI you've got. You could get a real police box and a real space-time vortex and film it falling through there and then throw the actor's face forward towards the camera. It still wouldn't be better.
I'm sure someone's done it on YouTube. I'm sure
probably,
it's there.
Probably. What about you?
Me, I think for me, the one that always gets me going is the Peter Howell 1980.
Right.
Are we
talking theme tunes now, aren't you?
I'm talking about the whole thing. I know it's very simplistic, but it works very well. And I remember as a kid finding it the use of space actually made me feel that the show was bigger than it actually was. It felt like you were sort of exploring the universe. And the music, even though the music was sort of quite upbeat in its own way, but there was a sort of quite an aggressive malevolence underneath it, which somehow the starkness of the space just seemed to work. Yeah. And then, you know, the big doom at the end of the end credits as well was a very powerful message. I didn't like it so much when it went to Colin Baker, where someone decided that it needed to be more glittery.
More jangling glittery, yeah. The thing about the first, sort of like from 1963 through 1979, is that it's essentially the same theme tune, isn't it?
There's
minor differences, but essentially it's the same arrangement, and it's done in exactly the same way. And then when the Peter Howell version comes along, it's like a kick in the head, isn't it?
It is, yes. But it's done in a way which a lot of theme tunes can't do. And I was very surprised when Murray Gold did the theme tune, and obviously we had the title sequence, as you say, for 2005, that he managed to do a version of the original which actually had power behind it and didn't sound crap. And it's a very odd theme tune, because it's very hard to do that in a way that doesn't sound crap. Even the orbital one, while it's fun, it doesn't have any weight, it doesn't have any energy to it in the sort of sense of the actual melodies. And Murray Gold, and especially the most recent one, with that new opening opening segment before it hits the original theme tune, is really quite powerful and effective. And I do quite like the new one. As I say, the Doors spoil it for me. I can't cope with them at all.
How does Brian feel?
Honestly, I was going to say the 1981, same as James, mainly because I have so many memories attached to it that it's the one theme tune that when it comes on that, you know, I just get super excited for. I don't know what it is. Like I'm attached to the Tom Baker titles from the previous years for him as well. Like, you know, I'm lashed to them, but I think that was a later in life. Like after I rediscovered the show, I became very attached to those. But when I did rediscover the show, hearing that 1980 tune and seeing that intro was like, yes, this is what I watched on PBS when I was a kid. And it was great because I spoke about it before, but I rediscovered the show when I was in high school, and I grew up with it, you know, when I was, what, I don't know, 8, 9, 10, something like that. But I've always loved that one. It's always the one that's just get me moving. There's something about watching Tom Baker's last season that I find very, some great memories attached to it. And I love the feel of that season. You know, my favorites for him are his originals, but there's something about this end that I just love so much. And I don't know, maybe it's just attached to things like that. I will say though, go on.
Yeah. I was going to say the other thing with the 1980s version is that seemed to be far more effort to sort of tie into the key of the sting. And so with the way it worked with the episode seemed to have a little more synchronicity.
It gets you pumping too, that music.
It does,
you
know? Doesn't it?
Yeah. It's weird. I mean, it's like pumping. It's odd. It's kind of got like an electric guitar kind of thing going on. And I've always said before, which, you know, I love the new series music. I love the Paul McGann music. But I think when you enter drums into it is when it starts to lose the fact that it's this this kind of spacey kind of feel to it. I think they need to come out again.
But that amazed me, actually. I have to sort of disagree. I totally agree with you. And yet, I think that was the thing which amazed me with the Murray Gold one, is that I'd never heard drums put into Doctor Who where it didn't just conventionalize it.
Yeah.
And I would still argue that it's still not quite got it like Peter Howell in either the 2005 version or the most recent one. The opening melody to the new version. But when it hits the theme tune, it sounds a bit weedy again, and it doesn't carry that. The only one that never sounded weedy to me was the Peter Howell, which it was just really in there. And the sounds were so electronic, but they were so wet that you couldn't really work out what the hell was going on. It was it did pump you up, and it didn't need drums, as you say. It didn't need any real conventional sounds. The only conventional sound really was a slight, you could hear the guitar synthed in there at some points, obviously in the middle 8-bit. But yeah, oh, no.
I agree with that. I like the new series theme songs, but like you said, the drums don't detract from them, but they don't exactly harm it. I just think that somehow they aren't necessary. They do work, but I do still feel that they aren't necessary. It is a tough thing to try and make this song successful, because so many people have tried to rewrite it or do their own version, and more often than not, I actually see it seem to fail. I'll tell you who did actually an interesting one was David Arnold when he did the Eighth Doctor theme tune for Big Finish. I actually thought that one worked pretty well. It's a little slower, but it seemed very interesting. It had a nice feel to it.
It's okay. I always like the twangly Elastic Band one myself.
I was just going to say that. No, listen. Okay, you're going to think it's silly. The Delaware theme.
Yeah, yeah.
Yes. When, I don't know how it was for you guys, I think it was probably the same, but when Carnival of Monsters came out on VHS, it was just discovered, like the bits were just discovered, or they were working off of the episodes, the early edit episodes that they had, I guess is what it was, because the actual aired versions were not existent anymore. I wasn't really aware of this for a long time. And when it hit DVD, they had re-edited it or found new edits to be the aired versions. I felt so dejected in a way watching it, because the Delaware theme was not there for some reason. That theme, I don't think it worked as a Doctor Who theme. I don't think it was right for the show, but it was right for that story, and I don't know how else to describe it, because that story was a bit silly. Everybody acting in it was acting a bit silly. It was a big carnival experience, and somehow that song just seemed to fit it. So when it was gone, it was like, no, that's my memory. You've just messed with my memory. And I understand it's not how it originally was, but somehow it just worked. And I was hoping that there was like an edit on there that was like, just for you, you know, just for your memory, Brian, here's the edit of the VHS for you. I would have loved that. They don't know me, so that won't happen. But it was cool. I liked it for that story.
Oh, well. Well, well, it is an interesting arrangement. It doesn't seem... It never seems completely wrong. That's the thing about it. It never pops up, and you never think, this is completely wrong. This doesn't work at all. It really does work with the titles.
It does, especially the way they have this kind of, like you said, the rubber band effect in the music, but they also did it with the titles. It was weird.
I always thought when I first heard it, I was obviously a little younger, and I wasn't really thinking hard. You know, is this the Australian version? Is
it, you know, the didgeridoo.
It's got a sort of didgeridoo sound to it. There was a bit of that in the 2005. It sounded like there was a little hint of that. What's about the 2007 version where they sort of beefed it? It was about 2007, I'm guessing off the top of my head, where they beefed it up a little bit for, I think it was the Donna season, wasn't it?
It was 2008.
2008.
Yes, it is a little beefier. Yeah. I've been watching series 4 lately.
Almost like they tried to do the 79 to 1980 change, because when you say beef it up, they definitely ramped up the guitar.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
I quite like it again. It's interesting. The only one that I don't like is obviously from the era which I have the fondest memories, or some of the fondest memories, of course, is the McCoy one, which was... Actually, no, I don't like the Colin Baker one, which has got a...
I don't. Is it the McCoy one? Because I think it's probably just familiarity with it. I know it's not brilliant, but it just feels nice to enjoy it.
There's some nice bits in it. There's some nice sounds in it. And again, like one
nice
thing
concept,
I hate
too.
The one thing I hated about the 2010 version is the same thing I hate in the McCoy version. Is the use of sound effects. I just don't think you need them.
Oh
A theme tune works without having to have the FX. We can see it. We don't need to know it's lightning. It doesn't add to the music. Get rid of it. Yeah. And the
it
same with those.
It actually really detracted that lightning when they put
it.
That
did.
In. Yeah, very much.
That was a bad move. And have they got rid of the sound effects on the new one? I can't really think about it now. The most recent. Is there any sound? I think there is sound effects.
I think
there
are like whooshings.
Yeah, just whooshes. I think. I think whooshes are more or less acceptable.
Just about. But I still think they're unnecessary. I mean, they had them in the Paul McGann one as well. And
yes.
No, you just don't need it.
You know, the one thing I will say, though, about Sylvester's titles, first of all, I don't mind the song that much. No, it's not the best one they had, but I will say you hear that song, you think of Sylvester, obviously.
Mm-hmm. Oh, totally.
You know, it's his music. I think his opening titles are not bad in concept. It's just with the technology that they had at the time, they look like a video game, unfortunately. Yeah. And I think if they were done today, that same concept with much better technology, I think I would actually like that intro. I did like how focused on the TARDIS a little bit and all like the comets and the bubble and so on. I don't know. As a matter of fact, that's a challenge. Maybe for the those that we have mentioned on this podcast that have actually done the titles for the new series. I wonder if anybody out there would be willing to try and update the Sylvester McCoy titles with the technology of today.
Yeah, it'd be interesting to see, wouldn't it?
I am just looking at some of the attempts. One person tried it by making it darker, which actually does help, be fair. It darkens it. You lose the sort of the power of the asteroids.
You just close your eyes, doesn't that work?
You can do that.
How certain things were angular, too, because they couldn't round them enough. They couldn't make them look realistic. Yeah.
A bit like the two
heads
in Dimensions in Time.
I've not judged this, but this is someone's attempt to do what we're just talking about. And it's mixed success, but it's quite interesting. Because it's an attempt. It's not perfect, but it's what we're talking about.
Oh, come on, it doesn't need the tech shop. Come on.
Or the wig.
There's some nice bits in it. Again, it suffers from the 3D actual aspects just don't work. And the TARDIS is even more basic than the one in the actual sequence. But yeah, if people can find stuff like this and show us how it should be done, I think
it's still glittery.
It's still glittery. Like, there's no ball around the TARDIS.
No.
Yes.
But you know what? It's not a bad attempt, though.
It's okay.
Yeah.
I mean, full credit to them for spending the time to do it. And, you know, it's nicely produced, but it doesn't do it for me.
No,
what I was going to say was it looks like another attempt in the era rather than today.
Yeah.
Yes, it does a bit. I mean, I quite like the very slow-moving sort of digital star galaxy feel. That was quite interesting, but it doesn't quite work. But it is an interesting thing for people to try, I think, just to see how...
It would be very cool, I think. Yeah, I would love to see somebody attempt it for sure. I mean, not that, like, again, like we were saying, that was not a bad attempt, but... Somebody can get it. Somebody can get it looking realistic. And that's what it is. I think that's all it needs is the comets need to look realistic. You know, the asteroid belt needs to look realistic. You know, the TARDIS, the box itself, you know, even the logo. It's a shame because it's Sylvester's logo, so I don't want to see it completely different. But I wonder if it can be made in such a way that it makes it look fresh. I don't know. I would love to see that done. I would love to see somebody take us up on that challenge.
It would be nice. I mean, speaking of music, if you missed it last week, dear listener, the most recent Dot 2 Proms was aired on BBC One last week, which you should be able to catch on BBC iPlayer for a few more days. Did you watch it, James?
I did, yes. I
enjoyed
it? I watched the recording live in the sense that I was alive and I watched it. And it was, I enjoyed it. I mean, I wasn't particularly interested in the interspersed bits, but I know people are, and that was cool. I thought it was a nicely done program. As I said at the time, what astounds me is I'm not a kid person. I'm not big on Munchkins either. You know, kids and munchkins. And just to clarify, we are talking about the fantasy munchkins. This isn't some sort of stupid euphemism here. But kids I have a problem with. But I did really like watching their faces in the proms, because there is the absolute, utter gobsmacked face that they all had, which means they haven't got time to be irritating or stupid because they're too busy being gobsmacked. And that's a wonderful position for a person like me to see kids who, as I've said before, not the brightest things, not the brightest block on the pile, are they? Not yet. They might do in the future, but at the time, let's face it, they're pretty thick. They've not got much to offer to you because they haven't had the experience. So when you go to see the prom, you don't want them talking. You want them to be gobsmacked because it's good for them and it's good for you. And they are gobsmacked. Their face, their jaws hang. They're just being, and I don't blame them. Who wouldn't, you know, sitting there with Cybermen? And what amazed me was obviously how light those cyber suits are, the new ones. Because one actually does a jump, doesn't he? He jumps and lands and scares the living daylights out of a couple of kids. But to do that, you know, a lot of those sort of get ups, you know, fiberglass, whatever, you wouldn't be able to do, but they seem to be quite agile.
Right.
It was pretty impressive. But yeah, the music was great, and I loved all of it. And I'm not too keen on some of the renditions in there. I think all the strange creatures was a little weak. But particularly the piece going through the history with Peter Howell and Mark Ayres was wonderful to watch, and to see the reaction to was lovely.
Mm. Yeah. So again, to just reiterate, if you can get your hands on watching that, if you missed it, then do so. Now, a quick item before we move on to recommendations, it's come along today. There's a series of Dot 2 games being produced, by Winning Moves UK. We're looking here. Sadly, there's no Monopoly mentioned, but there's a Doctor Who Trivial Pursuit, a Doctor Who Top Trumps Turbo board game with physical cards,
a
Doctor
Who
50th Anniversary Jigsaw, and far more excitingly, and I am going to get myself one of these, Doctor Who Risk: The Dalek Invasion of Earth. I'm having that. That's basically. I just wanted to talk about Risk. Basically, I wasn't interested in the other stuff. A Doctor Who strategy game after what? How long? I mean, I know there are some other Doctor Who strategy games like Battle for the Universe, but this Doctor Who Risk, brilliant, brilliant.
Do they change any of the rules? Do they add anything?
Although I don't know yet. Details are sparse at present.
But Jigsaw, does anyone do Jigsaws anymore?
My twins do Jigsaws. Oh. Wooden ones, though, because they tend to eat the cardboard of the other ones. Very good at them, actually, surprisingly. Yeah, better than I am.
Typical child behaviour. This is exactly what I'm talking about. If you said that your mate was quite good at Jigsaws, but he had a tendency to eat the cardboard, you go, what? Is he an idiot? But kids, we let them get away with it.
Yeah, all right. Recommendations time. James, you first?
Why? It's always me first. Brian first.
Oh, no, you see, it used to be me first, and then when I complained about it, we brought it on to you. But that's no problem.
It's a season to be merry, and I think it should go back to you. Well, it's getting there.
Okay.
Isn't it?
Not really, no. Well, carry on. One of you.
Carry on. Carrying on, yes. Recommendations. I have kind of sort of Doctor Who recommendation. Well, a slight Doctor Who recommendation, but otherwise I would start to give a recommendation for a TV show, which I actually just began watching. I'm very into it. It's not Doctor Who related at all, but what the heck, why not? Other people should watch it. I've been catching up on Breaking Bad, which I hear people talk so much about, and I have never watched it because I thought I wouldn't be interested in the subject matter, but I have to admit the show has done extremely well. And I've just finished the second season now. And one of the things that's getting me about it, although I'm told this may change, is that when they get to the end of the season, you expect this big game-changing kind of Russell T. Davis or Stephen Moffat season finale where everything explodes, the whole universe explodes, you know, kind of one of those things. But you don't. You just get another great story that could have happened anywhere else in the season. I mean, things are escalating, but it's just a great story. And I really appreciated that. Like, when you get to the end of the episode, you're like, wow, like, that was just a good story. There wasn't anything big here. No stereotypes, no nothing to fall into, essentially. And I really enjoyed it. So I would recommend that. I had a lot of fun watching those first two seasons.
Okay. James?
I finished The Reign of Terror, and I've been enjoying the extra features on it. Uh-huh. I've not got to the commentary yet, which I'm looking forward to. Even though I'm particularly looking forward to the commentary because the commentary's got a lot of bit character actors on there, actors which didn't have massive roles, which can sometimes be quite interesting because you get a different flavour to and perspective. So that's I'm looking forward to that. But the actual making of Reign of Terror was fascinating, especially with the breakdowns that the director suffered. By the sounds of it, to some degree or some large degree, maybe to William Hartnell. And how that sort of caused problems in production. So it's a very interesting making of on the Reign of Terror. And to be fair to Bill, he once things got sorted out, apparently he was very helpful and more engaging with the director. So, but that's an interesting story into itself. So yes, Reign of Terror, the animation on it is absolutely brilliant, spot on for the show. You don't, in fact, you kind of miss it when it goes back to the live version for episode 6. So yeah, Reign of Terror is my recommendation.
Okay. Well, mine is probably a couple of weeks ago, we had a news item on Cast Service that a bundle of ebooks were available, Doctor Who related ebooks. One of them was Who and Me by Barry Letts. So I've been reading that lately, and it's a remarkable read. You can hear it's completely Barry Letts. There's no, doesn't appear to be any sort of like ghost writing going on here. This is obvious. Obviously, I suppose, but you can hear Barry Letts' voice as you're reading it. It's a lovely book, full of interesting little stories, and there's sort of an explanation of how he came to be a producer rather than a director, which is what he intended to be. And then moving on to Doctor Who, and it seems to have been in a bit of a shambles when he took over as well, to be honest. Far more than you might have been previously aware of. It's a good read if you haven't read it already. I know it's been out for a few years now, but it was re-released when he passed away. And if you have the opportunity to get yourself a copy, I would heartily recommend it.
Hmm. That sounds interesting. I was never very... He's a funny guy, because he wrote, for some obscure reason, a couple of the Blake 7 BBC plays.
Right.
And he was absolutely abysmal. And it's funny how someone who is a good writer, I'm not knocking him as a writer at all, you know, can't write. Some people aren't suited to certain things.
Yeah.
And that was a shame because it was one of the more recent things he wrote, and it sort of really put me off him. And that's a shame because of his massive, fantastic commitment and legacy to Doctor Who. To be put off by two shoddy Blake 7 plays. But why they got him to write them, I've no idea. He's got no connection to Blake 7. But there you go.
Indeed. Well, that brings us to the end of this week's Cast Service podcast with a K. If you listener have any recommendation, do feel free to let us know. Well.
I've just had in, unfortunately. I'm just looking through the papers. Apparently, there are laws about maltreatment of munchkins.
Ah, okay. So we'll have to let them go.
Well, I think we can try and just be nice to them, maybe.
Okay.
It is some sort of, I don't know, some sort of subset of equal rights for fictitious characters that being used in a fictitious work employment. Buildings.
That is disappointing.
That is a shame.
Yes, it is. Maybe we'll just unplug the sonic screwdriver, see how that goes.
Yeah, but who's going to sort of undo all the mouse traps?
That'll be Brian's drawers? Job.
Oh yeah, Brian, you can do that.
Again?
Well,
afraid so.
You're good with your hands, I'm told.
Mrs. Right. So until next time, it's goodbye from us. Timing.